thank you, Alessia, and everybody else for the invitation to give a talk at PI. I oftentimes start with some disclaimer, and in this case, well, thank you for the invitation, of course. And one small trivia of information is that my actually first relevant talk ever was in 2009, and it was at a conference in PI, which had some overlapping with what we are talking about today, so asymptotic safety. And it was a great experience. Don't watch the talk because it was terrible. It was my first talk. The actual disclaimer is that I am going to give a very partial overview of some topics. And I will neglect a lot of literature that you might consider extremely important. So live with that. It's going to be partial and just finalized for what I want to go about in the talk. And the last thing is that it's 2030 for me after a long day of work. So also please be understanding if I might come across as sleepy or tired. So these are the disclaimers. Now, let's go to the part that you might not like if you're an expert of the topic, which is my non-comprehensive history, the very partial history of quantum gravity, which will serve the purpose of bringing me to the topic of the talk. So let's start with classical gravity, general relativity. I assume we all have some familiarity, degree of familiarity with general relativity. So I'm just displaying Einstein's action, in which you have the geometry of space-time through the curvature R of the Riemannian curvature scalar R coupled to, tells you the information about the geometry of space-time. It's coupled to some matter action. And if you perform a variation with respect to the metric of this action coupled to matter, you get the Einstein's equation. And the point that I wanted to get across this slide, which is of course trivial for a lot of you, is that the interaction of with matter of gravity, so is in the Einstein's equation, which are what are displayed in the center, is mediated modulo some constants through Newton's coupling G, okay? But also, it does not only mediate the interaction with matter, but somehow it mediates the interactions of gravity with itself. One way to see that is that which you see in the last line, you expand, for example, the metric about a flat Minkowski background. The natural expansion is what I display schematically below. It takes the form of a spin 2 action, and then there are interactions between fluctuations of the metric, in this case H, mediated again by G. And if you look at the expansion, the natural interpretation of the expansion is the one of an energy over the Planck mass, which is essentially the inverse of the square root of G. Now, we want to become quantum at some point, so I'm also going through steps to include the quantum effects. The first is the extremely famous computation done by Hawking, in which essentially you include the quantum mechanical effects in the case of Hawking's computation in a curved space-time of a black hole. So that is quantum mechanics over a fixed metric G mu nu. So it's not a quantum gravity, but it's quantum mechanics. And through this, the application of these methods, you can compute, for example, the Hawking temperature that tells you that the black hole radiates and points towards the fact that GR is somehow incompatible and incomplete if you want to look at quantum effects. And then a second step before quantum gravity would be to look into quantum field theory in curved space and include also back reactions effect in the Einstein's equation. For example, you can compute the expectation value of the stress energy tensor of a quantum theory in fixed curved space and put it into the Einstein's equation. It's essentially the same as in the previous slide, but with the quantum effects taken into account. And this is also kind of an intermediate regime between quantum mechanics and quantum gravity that has some potential applications, for example, in inflation, but you should ask some expert about it. And now I want to, after these first two steps, now I want to try to address the problem of quantizing gravity itself, in this case, quantizing the metric. Now, the symmetries of GR in some sense are broken. I'm putting it between commas because one should be careful with what is the meaning of symmetries of GR. But let's say GR is broken in the sense that we have an extended spacetime. So symmetries are broken in this sense. Translations are broken in this sense. And one thing that is obvious that if you work with a theory of a metric is that metric equal to zero is not a natural expansion point for a gravitational theory, Einstein-like theory. So one way to approach or circumvent this problem is to use a background field method. And what I'm displaying here is an Euclidean path integral constructed with a background field method. And schematically, it is the formula that you see in the center. So you take the metric and you write it as a fixed background and fluctuations, and you just integrate in some way, unspecified in this slide, you integrate over the fluctuations. And I'm also displaying the Euclidean version, assuming that I can somehow move from the Euclidean version to the Minkowskian version. And in this way, you get a sort of effective action from the path integral. And the effective action, in some sense, which should be analyzed more carefully, the effective action contains quantum effects inside. Now, what is the historically famous and the successful way in which people compute this kind of path integrals? Well, for example, using the loop expansion, which would be an expansion in powers of h slash, which is the reason why in the previous formula I was writing explicitly h slash instead of putting it equal to one. The loop expansion is what is schematically, well, actually, it's a relatively precise formula if you know what the drawings mean. The loop expansion is what explains schematically below, but the essential part is that you have a bare action and you have loop corrections. The loop corrections contain generally divergences in some sense, and these divergences have to be renormalized through some specific change of the bare action. Now, the loop expansion has been applied successfully in the early days of quantum gravity to some extent. And these slides are the successes of the loop expansion. For example, what you can do is you can compute the one loop, so just the first correction that was there in a dimensional regularization, which was a very popular method to compute. And what you get is that the divergent part of the effective action has the form and is quadratic in the Riemann curvatures, so Ricci square, R square, and a topological term. Which is the Euler characteristic in four dimensions. Now let's forget about the Euler characteristic. That's just topological, we don't care. What you notice is that the first two terms, Ricci and R, are actually zero for pure gravity if you evaluate them on shell, because the equations of the Einstein's equation just reduce to Ricci equal to zero. So there's no divergent part on shell for the effective action, and essentially this kind of divergence is not a problem. And one way to make it more formal is that if the effective action is zero on shell, it means that off shell you can essentially perform a redefinition of the metric. If you can think of it as a change in frame to some extent, but in general you can redefine the metric and essentially get rid of the divergence. So this divergence in this slide is not a problem. The problems arise when you go beyond pure gravity in any direction, essentially. For example, if you include a cosmological constant, what you notice is that the on-shell effective action, the divergent part of the effective action that I give you in the first line is non-zero, even if you go, even if you apply Einstein's equation, you have a term proportional to the cosmological constant square, for example, you can't get rid of it. And if you include matter of any type, you get something which is non-zero. And the most famous result is the one of Gorov and Signotti, which is what I'm showing in the last line. If you go to two loops, there is a term in the effective action which is proportional to the Riemann to the power three, and you can't get rid of it. And now, why are these terms a problem? Well, they are not present in the original bare action, so your program does not work. You can't renormalize them. You should include these operators in the bare action and repeat the computation. And what is known is that this procedure does not close, at least not evidently, from perturbation theory. So this is kind of, I mean, this is just a joke. This was the situation in 1985 when Gorov and Signotti published a paper. A lot of people, which later went on to become famous string theorists, essentially slowly murdered Caesar, which is representing the perturbative quantum gravity. Now, not everything is lost, actually, in this type of construction, because gravity can still be understood as an effective theory. And this kind of connects with what I was saying before about the perturbative expansion of the coupling. So the reason why the renormalizability fails is because Newton's constant is dimensionful, is actually a coupling of the of mass dimension negative two. So naturally, it induces an expansion, as I was saying, in energies over the Planck mass. So the loop expansion that I was showing you before, which is the first line, can be actually substituted in a meaningful way with an effective expansion in which the new terms that are appearing are subtracted, taking into account that they are proportional to some power of an effective scale M, typically, but not necessarily, typically identified with the Planck mass. And so all the new terms, which introduce new colors in this equation, actually don't have to be reabsorbed in the original action, which is still Einstein-Hilbert, but they can be, they are weighted by different powers of M. So they live together with their divergences. So, so this is the, if you want, the schematic way in which I depicted it to my students. And the net effect of performing an effective expansion is that you have new terms appearing in an uncontrolled way, like in the original H-bar expansion. But this time they are weighted by further powers of inverse powers of the Planck mass. If you perform the identification, and so if you are just looking at the theory for energies which are much smaller than the Planck mass, you can set an arbitrary, let's say, cutoff in this expansion and say, for me, it is sufficient to work to up to 1 over m to the power 4, and the effective action becomes predictive just because you're working at energies much smaller than Planck mass. And this is stuff that was studied a lot by Donoghue, which I know you had guessed some time ago for a debate on asymptotic safety. Now, let me try to move to the main topic of this talk, which actually has to do with asymptotic safety. So what we want to do is we want to circumvent the fact that the theory is effective. And to circumvent it, I'm going to adopt an early idea, which was also I think it can be traced back to several people, but especially Weinberg. And let me circumvent the effective expansion by just looking at the theory, not from the point of view of two dimensions, but looking at the theory from the point of view of two plus epsilon dimension. So if you look at Einstein-Hilbert gravity in arbitrary dimension, Newton constant is not dimension negative two in general, but it's the dimension d minus two. So for example, if you go to two dimension, the Newton constant is dimensionless. So it has the chances of being a perturbatively renormalizable coupling. So it actually turns out that Einstein-Hilbert is perturbatively renormalizable and asymptotically free in two dimensions. And the beta function, I'm displaying one beta function, I will clarify it later. It's negative and it has that 19 that you see in the upper formula. So the idea is that if you go to d equal to 2 plus epsilon dimension, the previously dimensionless coupling acquires a dimensionality. Here I'm measuring it in terms of some arbitrary RG scale, the one of dimensional regularization. And the beta function acquires a scaling term, which is linear and proportional to d minus 2. So the beta function, if you look at that beta function, it has two fixed points. There is an infrared attractive fixed point, which is the Gaussian one, which is, by its own name controls the infrared, or at least you hope it does. And but there is also another fixed point, which is ultraviolet attractive. Now, fixed points of the renormalization group can be understood as a scale invariant configurations of your field theory. So the idea, which was stressed by several authors, is that in the regime which we didn't have under control previously, so the one of the effective theory, for energies above the Planck mass, the effective action, instead of becoming completely uncontrolled, it goes to a scale invariant theory, which from the point of view of this slide is actually, let's say, associated with the fixed point of the UV attractive fixed point of the renormalization group. So the picture would be that you have some UV fixed point and then you go to the infrared in some way. Let me try to be more precise with the picture. So the idea of Weinberg is that you can make the theory meaningful and complete in the ultraviolet if you have a scale invariant RG fixed point. The one that I showed you in the previous slide is an example. And the fixed point has a finite number of UV relevant direction. The finite number of UV relevant directions underline, let's say, span a critical surface, which is what is depicted in the center. And from the UV from the UV fixed point, you have UV relevant trajectories spawning from it. And the physical meaning of these trajectories is best understood in a Wilsonian framework. So they are RG lines, and in the Wilsonian sense, they represent the trajectories of theories which have the same infrared physics. So they go towards the same infrared large scales behavior, if you want. Let me try to be even more precise, discussing why this is good. So why this setup is predictive. So one way in which it is naively explained by people is that one should locate oneself on the UV critical surface. And since the UV critical surface is finite dimensional, people say they need finitely many experiments to locate, which is naive, not incorrect, but naive. More precisely, what one should do in this type of setup, by the way, the picture has been taken by Wikipedia, In this type of setup, what one should do, one should integrate the RG trajectories all the way down to the infrared, so to the actual physics that we observe. And the actual physics, if you're looking at it from a statistical mechanics point of view, trajectories of the RG typically bring you in some phase, hopefully an extended one for gravity. And since the integration through the UV critical surface, since the integration goes through the UV critical surface, it should leave you with a finite number of parameters, which in principle you could interpret as couplings, although it's not necessarily trivial. The finite number of parameters is what you should be fixing with experiments. And the whole reason why I'm boring you with this stuff is that there is a big difference between the picture on the left that you find on Wikipedia versus the picture on the right, which has an explicit physical meaning. So what I'm showing you on the right is a correction to the propagation, say, of a photon. And you can compute this diagram and make it finite through renormalization. Then it is something which depends on the energy going in, Q squared. And if you take a derivative with respect to Q squared, you get something which behaves like the beta function, the abstract beta function that you compute, for example, in QED. So the abstract object, which is the analog of the theory space that is on the left, has a straightforward physical interpretation if you take simply a derivative of a process with respect to the energy Q squared. So the interpretation of parameters slash couplings is not always straightforward. And just to nod to the people that know it, know this this framework a little bit more, I wanted to stress that this interpretation is not straightforward, especially when you lack a mesoscopic interpretation of the effective action that you're computing. By mesoscopic interpretation, I mean an interpretation. Mesoscopic means at intermediate scale. So this type of interpretation, so the interpretation on the right is somehow tied to the fact that the coupling as a function of some energy has an actual physical meaning in terms of a process. And this is not trivial in the case of gravity. And one last point that I wanted to stress is that this infrared physics, since we discussed the results of effective field theory by Dong, you should somehow interpolate with the known results from the effective field theory limit the effective action that I was explaining before as an expansion in powers of 1/scale. So I noticed that there is a raised hand. Maybe there is a question.
Yeah, Omar, thanks so far. There's a lot of discussion of coupling of asymptotic safety to matter. And I had the impression that in that case, coupling constants are interpreted in the, like in the right-hand picture. Is that true? On the right-hand side, you know, that you have explicit processes and the coupling constants are interpreted like in the right-hand side.
So are you making, is this a question or a statement?
It's kind of a statement. I'm wondering if one should take these results more carefully or whether if you have matter, you do have a mesoscopic interpretation.
So I don't know if matter solves the problem. So you probably are more expert than I am. I don't feel like the problem is solved because, for example, Donoghue raises this problem every 2 or 3 years. No, but probably matter solves some issues. So, but I don't feel so. I mean, if you have some pertinent literature for me, I would be glad to read it. But I don't think that this is a completely solved problem. But I should be more precise. So, when I wrote this thing, I had in mind asymptotic safety with the effective average action. So for me, well, maybe I will come back to that later. If you agree with that, I will come back to
this point. Thanks.
So going back to the history, there is the famous result by Reuter in 1996. Before that result, let me stress, there was a period in which people transferred a lot of results from string theory to the context of gravity in 2 plus epsilon dimension. So they just elaborated what I was saying in the previous slides with the example of d equal to 2 plus epsilon. But of course, if you're working in d equal to 2 plus epsilon, epsilon is generally a very, it's an infinitesimal parameter. So you don't know how to go to d equal to 4. It's not clear whether you can trust the results or not. So the idea of Reuter was that it was necessary to use a non-perturbative method, and he used what he was an expert of, namely Wetterich equation, which is the equation that I'm displaying on the left. Now I don't want to elaborate on the equation, but let me elaborate actually to reply to the previous to try to reply to the previous question. So the Wetterich equation uses an average effective action, which is constructed by integrating modes of the theory with respect to an infrared cutoff k. Now this equation is known to be a mesoscopic. This action is known to have a mesoscopic meaning in some cases, mostly involving scalar fields. I don't think that it has been proven that it has a mesoscopic meaning in general. This doesn't mean that it does not have a mesoscopic meaning, but it could be that that there is more work to be done in this direction. So what we know for sure of this type of equation is that if you follow the integration, which is what I was trying to say before with a picture, if you follow the equation all the way to the infrared, in this case to k equal to zero, then this action interpolates with the effective action. So this is what I was trying to say before. So if you have fixed the infrared action through an integration, then this infrared action depends on a finite number of parameters, and this finite number of parameters must be fixed in some way through experiments. Nevertheless, so I mean, this is a bit of a technical thing. The less technical thing is that if you use this equation, Reuter finds, and this is what is depicted on the right, a non-perturbative fixed point. In this case, it is depicted in the plane of a Newton constant and cosmological constant in units of the cutoff k. It has a spiral, but it also has some nice features. So it's ultraviolet. It is connected, and that's the green trajectory. It is connected to the Gaussian fixed point. So it goes to the Gaussian fixed point. And there are also trajectories slightly offset on the right of the green trajectory, which follow the scaling dictated by the Gaussian fixed point. So somehow it has the necessary ingredients to actually interpolate to the effective theory, for example, the one in the infrared, the one of Donoghue. So this is the good. What is the bad, in my opinion? Well, one point is how this computation was done. So for example, Reuter projected the theory through a truncation of the effective action, which includes two operators and two scale-dependent couplings. So this does not have the meaning that I was describing before of a bare action that has to be renormalized. So this is an approximation. And On top of this approximation, we added 20 years or even more of work, in which, actually more than 20 years, in which we added operators after operator to test whether this truncation was actually capturing the essential part of the physics. So two other points which are important for the rest is that this operation, so if you look at the results of several papers, including Martin's, the results are gauge dependent. So if I make explicit the parameters alpha and beta in red of the gauge fixing, those appear in the final results. So that means that the final results are not, strictly speaking, physical. And the results are also being discovered to be dependent on the way in which you actually parameterize the fluctuation. So, for example, you can expand instead of linear fluctuations of the metric, you can include also quadratic fluctuations with a parameter. And all these dependencies are not bad by themselves, but they should be getting rid of, first of all, and second of all, they kind of mix. So if you perform the computation, they all these parametric dependence with respect to gauge, approximation, expansion, they kind of mix. So qualitatively, one gets always the same picture that I was showing in the previous slide, but quantitatively, it's difficult to trust the actual physics of the prediction. Now, there are a lot of words in this slide. Let me try to go through them. So the literature of asymptotic safety had to face some problems. And in my opinion, we didn't face the other communities always in the best way. So, for example, well, one difficulty that we as practitioners of asymptotic safety always have to face is the necessity to communicate the meaning of power law divergences. So having a computation that only relies on dimensional regularization, even though you think it's not necessary or stupid, is actually very useful if you're trying to communicate the result. And one thing that I always thought was a bit unfair is the way in which we describe truncations. We often, of the effective action, we often refer to them as non-perturbative approximations, as if they are something good and better than perturbation theory, but they're not. They are an approximation, and one should try to control the approximations. And I don't think we have alternative ways to look at asymptotic safety besides, not many at least, besides the application of the Vetteri-Sharg. So it seems exclusive to the application of this equation, which is also not a very good thing. And well, let me skip the last point. Well, I'm also guilty of these things. And do I have solutions to these problems? No. So don't expect me to say solutions in the next 10 slides. But let me try to show you something which I thought, no, based on the bad things that I said on the previous slide, something which I felt like it was important. And for me, it was important to go back to some universal results, which I was showing you before, in 2 plus epsilon dimensional gravity. So the limitations is going to be epsilon small. Now, the story of 2 plus epsilon dimensional gravity was very confusing for me at the beginning. So you started with a bare action, which should be in D equal to 2, but for some reason I wrote it in D equal to 4. So that should be in D equal to 2. And if you check the literature of gravity in two dimensions, what you find are, let's say, two sets of notable works. And the two sets find two different beta functions. So there is one with 19 highlighted in red on top of the beta function, and one with 25 highlighted in red. And I was very confused. So I initially wasn't able to understand why people were getting different results, and it wasn't at all clear to me. So the way in which I explained it to myself was through the work of some people that I didn't cite, but Gillen, Percacci. So they discussed the topic of symmetries in theories with a metric gravity and siblings, let's say. So in GR, symmetries in some sense of the word are the diffeomorphism group, which are generated locally, sorry, infinitesimally by a vector field, and that would be the transformation on top. But there is an alternative way of looking at these symmetries, which involves rewriting the metric in terms of a conformal factor times a metric with a fixed determinant. So you can think at the metric G tilde that you see in the second line of the text as an equivalence class of metrics with the same determinant. So a unimodular metric can be called. And what you can do is you can split the transformation of the diffeomorphism. So the first one, you can split it between a unimodular metric and a conformal and the conformal factor in the way that I show. So the split is unique because what you want is that the unimodular metric does not change the determinant through a split. So you stay in the same equivalence class. And what you can show is that the second set of transformations are isomorphic to the original diffeomorphisms, but they're not exactly the same. So they have the same algebra, but they are not exactly the same. And you can write them as a broken coset of the diffeomorphism group and the Weyl group. And this other realization, so if the other one is the Einstein realization, this other realization would be people called it unimodular Dilaton gravity. But they are classically the same, they have the same symmetries. But quantum mechanically, these two realizations can be different. And this is how I explained to myself the difference between 19 and 25. So if I perform the usual path integral using the diffeomorphism, the Einstein realization of gravity, I get the 19. If I instead perform the path integral with the unimodular Dilaton realization, I get 25. So this I checked explicitly. Both of them, however, so both of the series of papers of the past have a number of points that should be stressed. So if, for example, if you follow the traditional Einstein route, what happens is that the metric in two dimensions has a discontinuity in the number of degrees of freedom. So the metric in two dimensions only has the conformal mode modulo global topologies. This is well known by string theorists. So there is this discontinuity, and this discontinuity happens to actually produce a kinematical pole, 1 over d minus 2 in the propagator of the metrics fluctuations. And what Jack and Jones were trying to do in the past, they were trying to get rid of the kinematical term through a procedure like the subtraction of divergences in dimensional regularization. And this was always varying. So they showed it's actually an inconsistent procedure, but we know why, because there are, so if you practice loop expansion, there are very tight relations between the poles. So you can't throw in an additional 1 over epsilon and show that it works. And let me also add the one thing that actually r equal to 0 on shell, which is something we somehow saw before in the d equal to 4 case. So even if you get a pole 1 over epsilon times r, this is unphysical. So it goes to 0 on shell if you're studying pure gravity, obviously. In the case of 25, so people noticed that there was a strong relation between, so in the case of what I call unimodular dilaton gravity, the people noticed that there was a strong relation with string theory. And the reason why there is a strong relation in string theory is that people in string theory, when quantizing the string, they are integrating the conformal modes of the metric. And so you can think of the metric as, let's say, non-conformal modes, and which is just the dilaton and the conformal modes. So there is a way to explain why we got 25, because 25 is 26 minus 1. And 26 is the result of string theory. So this numerology can actually be made more precise. So, but trust me, 25 is 26 minus 1. Which undoubtedly you know already. The one interesting aspect of preserving diff star is that in the coset that I was showing you before, what you want to preserve is the Weyl subgroup, because you're breaking it down together with diff to create the unimodular dilaton construction. And what in two dimension you can preserve Weyl symmetry through the inclusion of a topological charge. I'm showing it later, and it's not clear to me, or at least it wasn't clear to me when reading those papers, if this procedure can actually go through an extension from d equal to 2 to a different dimension. The reason why is that anomalies. So the way it was computed, it was tightly related to d equal to 2. But when I started this project, just to tell you my starting point, I was extremely biased towards finding 25, although open to change, as you're going to see. So for the strategy to compute counter terms in dimensional regularizations, what I wanted to do, I wanted to be sure that my results could be extended away from two dimensions. So we thought about a strategy to regularize divergences in a way that we would somehow keep in dimensional regularization, but simultaneously keeping the dependence of the dimensionality. So in an extremely summarized way, what we do is we regularize the Feynman diagrams in dimensional regularization, actually below two dimensions, because that is convenient, because there's no conformal mode instability. So what happens above two dimensions is that the kinetic term of the conformal mode can have the Vron sign. But if you stay below two dimensions, at least analytically, you don't see the conformal mode instability. And but we also treat every other dependence on the dimensionality, for example, the trace of the metric that is D, we treat it as a parametric dependence, which has nothing to do with epsilon of dimensional regularization. And this to me sounds like when you compute, for example, the beta functions of gauge theories, that you have an explicit dependence on N, which is very important if you're looking at the conformal windows and stuff like that. And then the last step is to continue the theory, crossing fingers and hoping that it works, continuing the theory above two dimensions. So this is the three-step strategy that we invented. And if you apply this strategy to the Einstein realization with the traditional diffeomorphisms, you get at one loop an effective action like the one that I'm displaying to you. And for the ease of reading, I color-coded in blue the presence of the kinematical pole that I was mentioning before. In green, a parametric dependence on the way in which you expand the metric, and in red, the gauge dependence. And as you can see, so in these two lines, this would be normally or naively counter terms to the cosmological constant and to the Newton's constant. These two counter terms have a heavy and mixed dependence on the three colors. Okay, so they're not straightforwardly physical. But one way to get rid of this dependence is to go on shell. So to go on shell, what we do is essentially we parameterize the divergence in terms of a scalar curvature plus a term which has essentially a source for the equations of motion. So if you go on shell, the source decouples because the equations of motion go to zero. If you do that, you can determine the two coefficients, and magically, the coefficient of the equations of motion, so the J mu nu, which sources the equation of motion, takes inside all the previously unwanted dependencies. Instead, the coefficient of the scalar curvature is completely independent of any parameters. Now, if you go through the other two steps, so the last step of the procedure, you extend the computation from d equal to 2 to d equal to 2 plus epsilon dimension, the beta function, so the coefficient becomes essentially the beta function of the Planck mass. You go to d equal to 2 plus epsilon dimension, you acquire a scaling term, and the final result is essentially a beta function like the one that I'm showing in the bottom left, which depends on d. And the nice result is that for d equal to 2, it actually goes back to the result originally computed by Jack and Jones, but without all the problems that they were deeming the end point of the computation. So you get 19. And this beta function, thanks to the fact that we kept the dependence on D, let me stress, it's perturbative, but if you trust it, in the sense that if you decide that epsilon is D minus 2, you can compute very easily that it has a conformal window. So there is a certain interval in which there is a UV fixed point. So the UV fixed point exists only for D, the dimensionality of spacetime, slightly smaller than 7.6. Smaller than 7.6. So this was already found by Foles with different methods. So we just confirmed his results. And like many of the things that I'm telling you, they're not particularly new, but I really had the need to study this type of things and convince myself that they were consistent. So, but this result I like very much. The conformal window extends up to d equal to 4. Concerning the unimodular dilaton realization, I still had to make sense of that because it was getting a different result. And what we notice is that if we actually work following precisely the same steps of the previous realization, actually, also the unimodular dilaton realization outside the d equal to 2 gives the same result, so 19 in the beta function. But there is a special case which works only in d equal to 2, in which the dependence goes away. So it drops the gauge dependence and parametric dependence drop anyway, independently of the rest. And essentially what we noticed and showed a little bit is that you can introduce the topological charge that I was mentioning before to restore the Weyl symmetry for the theory. And this works only in d equal to 2. So these are two different things in principle that only work in d equal to 2, but I suspect that they are more intimately related. Only in d equal to 2, the topological charge, which is what I show below, it breaks Weyl invariance at the classical level, but the topological charge does not receive a radiative correction from the renormalization group. So it's a free parameter. And one can do, and it has been done for a long time in string theory, you can set the value of the classical value of Q that classically breaks Weyl invariance, but quantum mechanically cancels with the radiative correction to the anomaly. So essentially, you can preserve the Weyl invariance quantum mechanically by breaking it classically. And if you follow all these steps, you get the 25, which, as I said, was consistent with string theory. Now, what are some perspectives of this work? As I said, a lot of the results that I showed you are not particularly new, but I try to frame them in the best and most precise way possible. What I personally would like to see is the extension of the results for the Einstein realization to two loops and compute the next two leading corrections to the conformal window, just to see how they behave. Does it increase? Does it decrease? I don't know. But I would like to see if it works, if our three steps recipe works, and what does it do. The other thing that I would like to see, but at this stage I'm perhaps less interested, but I think it is still interesting, is to look at the unimodular dilaton realization, but in d equal to 4. Now, in d equal to 4, there is a perturbatively renormalizable theory of gravity, which is higher derivative gravity. And it also has a conformal anomaly. There are actually two, let's call them, it's not entirely precise, but there are two charges, let's say. And I would like to see a unimodular dilaton higher derivative gravity and to cancel the four-dimensional anomaly in this type of theory. I think it would be interesting to do, and certainly doable. Now, my point, the point that I wanted to come across to give is that I think this work is perturbative, so it's extremely limited from some points of view, but it should give lessons to the non-perturbative functional methods. For example, we should go on shell to have a physical gauge independent results. So the spiral plot that I was showing you some slides ago is amazing, interesting, but it is not physical. We should go on shell. And I think it would be enough, at least for me, even if by going on shell in functional methods, even if we're still left with some dependence on the parameters, I think it would be enough for me to know that in the perturbative case, these parameters are dropping out thanks to the fact that you are going on shell. So I trust more, I would still trust more the approach if we will start going on shell in the future. So this is essentially the point that I just wanted to make. And the very last thing, and then I know I'm a little bit over time. The very last thing that I wanted to share is that thinking at universal models like the two of quantum gravity in d equal to 2 plus epsilon that I was showing made me think about, well, actually infinitely many power counting randomizable bare actions that we can construct in dimensions different than 2 and 4. The first example would be d equal to 6. And but we are lucky because Benjamin worked on the d equal to 6 case. So these type of models my perspective on the topic is that first of all it's interesting to study them just for theoretical reasons. But my perspective on the topic is that they might have an interplay with the ultraviolet fixed point that I was showing you for gravity, which is supposed to, from the point of view of the conformal window, to disappear at some point. One mechanism for this fixed point to disappear is that it actually annihilates with another fixed point. So by exploring other universal models, you can find candidates of theories, which you could call multicritical generalizations of gravity, which could actually have an interplay and cancels out with this ultraviolet fixed point. So the first non-trivial example would be the one in D equal to 6 minus epsilon gravity, which, as I said, has been addressed recently by Benjamin. I think beyond that, we are at the point of diminishing return, because as you can see already, the six-dimensional action is extremely complicated. So the computations are getting harder and harder. So perhaps it's less interesting to go beyond. But these are all theoretically interesting models. So thank you. Sorry if I went over time a little bit.
Thanks, Omar, for this very interesting talk. Okay, are there questions? And first, I would take questions from students. I don't see at the moment questions from students. So are there questions from anyone else in the audience? Benjamin?
Yeah, thank you, Omar, for this really nice talk. You certainly clarified some of my questions already. So maybe a more general point. So if we look at the dimension as something which is not integer, but at the same time, we look at curvature tensors, which vanish below certain dimensions, we might get non-smooth behavior through the dimensions if we vary from 2 to 3, from 3 to 4, or something like that. So have you thought about that? What's your take on it?
Well, I don't know about gravity because I never studied this type of situation in gravity, but let me give you an example. So the Landau Potts field theory has a parametric dependence on the parameter Q, which represents the number of states of the Potts model. If you change Q, so you can construct the path integral in a way that depends parametrically on Q. So if you change Q, what happens is that for every natural value of Q, you have operators which are becoming the same. So for Q equal to 2, you have two different operators. For Q equal to 1, they actually are the same. And what happens in conformal field theory, they generate, so you have two, let's say, critical deformations with two different critical exponents, but they clash and they become what is known as a logarithmic pair, which is almost like traditional critical models, except that some correlators have a logarithmic correction. So I assume that your question was related to the fact that you have two different invariants of the type Riemann cube in the D equal to 6 action.
For example, but I mean, even below 4 dimensions, at some point, the right tensor drops out, at some point, the Ricci tensor drops out.
I would say probably there is some clashing of operators which become part of the same scaling multiplet. And when they do, they produce logarithmic corrections. So essentially, they're critical exponents, trivial. When you have two equal critical exponents, then you have the subleading logarithmic part.
I see.
But there can be interesting physics hidden inside. So I think it would be interesting to study some situations like this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Are there other questions? Okay, so let me also ask something. So at some point you say that using the functional normalization group techniques, we have of course a bunch of dependencies on gauge parametrization and truncation, and you say that this is at the level of the final results. But it is not clear to me what you mean by final results. I mean, if you really meant at the level of the effective action, because I mean, if one then goes to observables, so physical quantities, then dependencies in principle should drop off, at least in ideal non-truncated
You're right. So you're right. If you integrate DRG all the way to the infrared, then the dependencies drop out. So we agree on that. And which is why I was making the distinction between here, that you should follow the trajectories all the way to the infrared and fix the physics there, versus making some physical prediction based on a point. I don't know if you can see my pointer.
Yes.
A point at some random point in the middle of the line. So the whether you can use that trajectory outside its far infrared is a marked distinction between this picture and the picture on the right, in which we know that we can use that diagram. Asymptotic safety, sorry, asymptotic freedom has been tested with colliders, no? So and the testing was essentially based on something like this. So, but you're right. Mathematically, if you have the equation integrated down to the infrared, all the way down to the infrared, all dependencies drop out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would have other questions, but I would give priority to other participants, and I see a raised hand by Charlie.
Hi. So I'm a student, and I don't have a lot of experience with dimensional regularization. So I just want to ask a few questions about that. So I guess mathematically, I understand, like, you know, you're changing D by some epsilon. But I was wondering if there is a clear or even just potential geometric understanding of what that would mean. I know that like fractals have non-integer geometries. So are you like, is there any sense in which you could understand this in terms of fractal geometries, or is that kind of taking it too far?
I think you're probably, it's kind of taking it too far. I'm no expert, and actually I have been raised outside the dimensional regularization. I've been raised with the momentum cutoff. So it's always a little bit difficult for me to fully defend dimensional regularization. But I think the safest way is to not put too much meaning on it. It's one way to just hide infinities. But I might be entirely wrong, and maybe in the future people develop a fractal interpretation in a much more precise way. And then I will be proven wrong.
Okay. And I guess my other question is, I was wondering if, again, maybe this is not a well-founded question, but I was just wondering if, like, the dimension itself could run with scale. So you could have, like, if that makes any sense. Because I know, again, with just my limited understanding of how fractals work, and again, maybe that's not super relevant, but, like, you know, you could imagine, like, the dimensionality of space-time changing with scale. I was wondering if this sort of approach would maybe ever have anything to say about physics like that.
No, absolutely. Actually, this is, so it's not a naive question. It's actually very interesting. People have been working on it. So a lot of approaches to quantum gravity actually try to determine the dimensionality. In this specific approach, you kind of have a naive or bare dimensionality that you start with, and then you could imagine some means to measure the effective dimension of space-time. So people have invented geometrical observables and other ways to measure the dimensionality. For example, one popular way is it's called the spectral dimension, and it's kind of a fractal dimension. And what you do is imagine you have a particle propagating in space-time and coming back. If the space-time is black, flat, like a blackboard, it comes back with probability which is scales with the length of the path to the power 1 over d minus, sorry, it's 1 over the length to the power d over 2. So if you can measure the return probability of a particle, then you measure the dimensionality. So people have been doing experiments, theoretical experiments in models of quantum gravity measuring this return probability, and you get different values. It's an actually interesting observable of space-time, the one that you mentioned. In this sense, the fractal interpretation is much more pertinent. For dimensional regularization, I wouldn't instead apply a very deep interpretation.
Thank you.
A question by Bianca next.
Hi. That's probably a silly question. Since you got these two results, people got the two results with 19 and 25 connected to diffios or taking what you call diff star and the Weyl group. Can one actually adopt like the 19 result for string theory and then get a completely different critical dimension?
I think there was one person speculating on it. I found the reference through some papers by Reuter and Nink. But I'm not sure that it's precisely the same interpretation that I was giving, but this person was finding 19 as one of the critical dimensions of string theory. Uh-huh. Through a slightly different logic. So there can be potentially a relation, but I'm not really an expert on it. Maybe Dario Benedetti knows more because I remember some numerology in one of his papers and also 19 was appealing. So maybe he knows more.
I guess if you, Jan would also probably comment or anyway. Jan Ambion. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he might also have.
I didn't know I had him in the audience. Well, then he is.
He's not in the audience. But
okay.
You probably encounter him more often, you could ask.
Sometimes.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I don't know if you noticed that for a moment I was afraid that he had listened to all of the.
No, he's not here.
Okay. Are there other questions? So let me also ask something quick related to what you said regarding the paper by Martin. He also had, in a sense, a similar results about two different universality classes for quantum gravity related to two different central charges that I believe where they were indeed these numbers 25 and probably the other one. I don't remember the other one, but in that case, it was related to parametrization of the metric. In your case, it is related to different realization of diffeomorphism in the sense of two different limits of a bigger group. So do you think there could be, in principle, any relation or it is just a coincidence in a sense that there are these similar numbers?
So first of all, the two universality classes, so the fact that I call them two universality classes is totally inspired by their paper. But for everything else, we are right and they are wrong. They are the two results, 19 and 25. They see them as resulting from parametrization, which is not wrong. If you express all the results as physical things, so you go on shell and blah blah blah, you always get 19. Outside the equal to 2, and you get 25 in a special way in the equal to 2 only. So I think that from my point of view, our paper, even though the purpose of our paper was much smaller than the longer paper that you have in mind. In our paper, it's clearly explained that if they actually went on the shell, well, I mean, they're not entirely wrong either, because in that paper, they work a lot in D equal to 2. And in D equal to 2, as I said, you have two different values and two universality classes. So, but trust my paper. And don't tell Martin about this.
Good. So thanks for your answer. Are there final questions to Omar? Okay, if not, I would ask everyone to unmute yourself to clap your hands and thank Omar.
Thank you.